sufficient one. These intuitions include a compounding of time, so that we can see how things tend and how they might complete themselves out of the constrained variables of the reality we posit for them. I can see I am assuming that these things occurring in time encounter a kind of contrary wind, what time itself might be if it were symmetrical, or if it is, for that matter. The completion of a character or a fiction, a play or a poem, must have the look of teleology, a denouement that seems prepared and inevitable, that seems to have approached, not simply to have eventuated, to have arisen within the arbitrary limits imposed by every good choice made in the course of its invention, not as a foreshadowing, but as a reality still imminent. Entelechy. I suspect I have not mentioned grace at all. To me it means, among many things, a sense of or participation in the fullness of an act or gesture, so that the beauty of it is seen whole, the leap and the landing. Ethically, it means an understanding of the wholeness of a situation, so that everyone is understood in her humanity, the perceiver extending no more respect to herself than to others, understanding any moment as a thing that can bless time to come or poison it. As an aesthetic, for the novel at least, both the first and second definitions are in play. Theologically, grace must include the fact that we have untried capacities to live richly in a universe of unfathomable interest, and that we can and do, amazingly, enhance its interest with the things we make. Isn't it true that we actually add things to the universe, the great plenum? And this is true, I would say, by the grace of God. A proof, a test, an instruction. The Nation, December 5, 2016. Let us say, as a thought experiment, that history and providence conspired to create a president suited to 21st century America. He might unite in his own person the two races that are shorthand for difference and division within the society and have deep personal bonds with both black and white. Race has only the meaning culture gives it, and we learn every day that culture is a heavy-handed enforcer of the distinctions it has made. An ideal president would be one suited to his circumstance, to dealing with the potent aftershocks of an unjust and violent history. If it were clear that he loved and honored and identified with both streams of his heritage, he would bring as much humanity to this grievous old affliction as any one person could bring to it. Only imagine how the unacknowledged empire our country has become would be made more knowing and refined if this president had the memory of passing his childhood among the children of societies that seem remote to most of us, chasing a tattered kite down a muddy road, hearing the call to prayer, learning new forms of courtesy, seeing the effects of lawless government on the lives of good people. Again, if this president had family who were part of the emergence of Africa from centuries of colonialism, a continent at the threshold of the world's future, a complex and fragile phenomenon capable of igniting and also extinguishing extraordinary individual gifts, he would have a vantage point uniquely suited to his responsibilities toward this volatile planet. In both cases, he would have 10,000 times the understanding that is supposed to be acquired in congressional junkets and sophomore years abroad. This is a kind of understanding individual Americans are happy to claim on the slightest grounds. Oddly, at the same time, the public seems to be flattered by the notion that a real America would be more provincial than it ever was, isolated from the effects of foreign influences, as colonies in a mercantile empire, then as an immigrant country, never could be. Those who speak of the United States as great, formerly if not at present, must acknowledge that immigration has been concomitant with our greatest moments, wherever they wish to locate them. It is perverse, though clearly effective, to treat deep experience of other cultures as compromising. The candidate John Kerry spoke French, so much for him. So did Jefferson and Franklin and Adams, and they read it, too, as educated Americans did during that seminal period, to our benefit, no doubt. The United States is a very great power. It created its modern posture against an adversary it took to be equivalent to itself, perhaps even more powerful. The opponent has fallen away, more or less, and America is left with an overhanging capability to do harm, which is an important definition of power. This capability may no longer be suitable for deterring threats to us, but it is real and undiminished. As we learned in the course of this instructive election season, there are those who think that since we have it, we might as well use it. Not against Russia, of course, that important region in the new nation of oligarchia, but against ragtag radicals who torment regions that do not heed the further catastrophes our power would visit on them. No war will end war, short of Armageddon, so we had better consider other options. A president for whom other societies are not abstractions, who knows that the children of our enemies are as silly and lovely as our own children, would be well suited to helping us live more consistently with our values, granting all the obstacles history has put in his or her path. The success with which Barack Obama has been estranged in the minds of many Americans, made to seem foreign on precisely the grounds that made him singularly qualified for his office, reflects a refusal to accept what America is, not only a multi-ethnic and multi-racial nation, but a pervasive cultural and economic presence in the world, with responsibilities equal to our influence, a daunting thought. We are mighty, and the world is in every way fragile. Tact and restraint, where possible, are indicated. But we, politicians, journalists, cultural figures, do little to encourage a temperament suited to our role. The growing din of our politics and of the media fantasists who create terrifying worlds of threat and deceit and who increasingly shout down our politics is not likely to yield a mature consensus about our role and our obligations. It is true, historically, that Americans in meaningful numbers have mocked and bedeviled our great presidents. They, being great, have tended to do good things for good reasons, and therefore to be able to answer reasonable criticism. This fact has led their detractors to resort to scurrility potent in its time. Abraham Lincoln was mixed race, Franklin Roosevelt was Jewish, and now Barack Obama is Muslim. The notion, given force by the insistence of those who propagate it, is that Islam itself is evil and full of insidious intent, as Judaism was said to be in the 1930s by those who wished to discredit Roosevelt. The object in every case is to instill the belief that a great deception has been carried out, the true character and motives of the president are sinister, his government is illegitimate and must be opposed. I do not share the exceptionalist or providentialist faith that malicious behavior, outright slander, is somehow vindicated by the fact that we have survived it so far. I don't accept the view that playing on prejudices is just another part of political give and take. I think history has indulged us, allowing us to get away with abusing the democratic system in ways it will not sustain forever. Would anyone object to what I have said here? Well, in fact, Barack Obama would object. It is a remarkable thing to have some meaningful conversation with a president of the United States, in this case, a man young enough to be my son. Barack Obama is gracious, poised, and intense in the face of concerns and demands I cannot imagine. There is a sentence in a benediction common in mainline churches like his and mine, "Return no one evil for evil, but in all things seek the good." It seems to me always that his remarkable dignity and resilience must have its source in a transvaluation of this kind. He is extraordinarily alert. His attention runs a little ahead of the moment, to the next question, to the courtesy or reassurance he thinks the moment might be about to demand of him. It must be clear to anyone who has read his books that he is eager to learn from any encounter that might yield insight into a kind of query he brings to experience, which is, I think, an openness to an extremely inductive understanding of value, one that he is always ready to expand and refine. Though he would not apply such words to himself, the president is a philosopher, perhaps a theologian. In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man might seem delusional. There are risks in having an interesting mind in this odd climate we have made for ourselves. There are risks also in being in fact faithful to the faith so many of us claim. The president is taken in some quarters to be non-Christian because he is disinclined to hate his enemies. This can only mean that an uninstructed and unreflective Christianity has indeed taken hold in the population. The wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God, according to the Epistle of James. But we have lived for years with the raucous influence of self-declared Christians who are clearly convinced that their wrath and God's righteousness are one and the same. Then when the president, though he is insulted, balked, and provoked, refuses to yield to anger, his self-possession is apparently unreadable. A considerable part of the population must have ceased to recognize and respect piety, not to mention simple dignity. President Obama would say that my thinking is far too harsh, distracted by the nonsense of the moment, and that the essential thing, the thing that always wins out finally, is the goodness and wisdom of the American people. Only confidence in the ultimate wisdom of the people makes democracy sustainable through crises. The dynamic of the system assumes dispute and contentiousness, but respect for this dynamic and for those who sustain it, however heated the argument, is vital to democracy. In the long term, on the whole, respect will prove to have been justified and to have kept contention from flying out of control. I hope he is absolutely right, and that his capacious optimism can embrace my indignation as, by his lights, a necessary energy, together with all the contending passions that drive the country forward. President Obama is fascinated by the cohesion of communities and societies, by the numberless people who day after day do the numberless things that sustain the life of a city. He has seen what happens where cohesion fails, in America and elsewhere, and this no doubt makes him more aware than most of us are of its value, its beauty, its enormous fruitfulness. This awareness of the value of community also gives context to his equal and deep respect for all lives lived honorably and responsibly, and to his desire to help the marginalized enrich and enjoy the good life of community. This is a consistent element in his thinking. He often quotes the phrase, a more perfect union, which is first in the list of purposes for which, according to its preamble, the Constitution was ordained and established. The language assumes union, and acknowledges at the same time that this union is flawed and difficult. The comparative more implies that it will be improved rather than perfected by the new Constitution. Realism on the part of the founders, no doubt, who were already dealing with contending regions and interests. But that more also implies relative perfecting yet to be done, a continuous adjusting of law and custom to more nearly align them with the ideals expressed in the Declaration of Independence and the First Amendment. It is because there is the fact and the strength of union, whatever its failings, that these failings can be alleviated or overcome. I was in college when Margaret Mead was in her glory, and anthropologists could still claim to find societies untouched by the modern world. The idea was that in such places, human nature would have been preserved in a purer form than in the rationalist and technological societies of the West. By observing these societies, we could learn what we are essentially and how we ought to live. These societies were gentle, violent, uninhibited, and so on, depending, it came to seem, on the preferences of the anthropologist. People who have no historical memory in the Western sense, and who are engrossed in their lives, may not think to wonder what drove their ancestors to the depths of a forest and deprived them of the benefits of better resources and wider contact. In any case, the primitivity of these populations could in general be called poverty. Globally and historically, it would seem to be natural in human societies to create wealth, however badly they distribute it. So the isolation of such groups was probably more defensive than Edenic. In retrospect, this thinking seems akin to some of the less savory rages of decades just preceding it, having to do with purity and authenticity, the radical undermining of self and identity supposed to result from foreign influence and racial or ethnic mingling the same kind of nostalgia that had mocked up Norse cults and druidic rituals, and that is stirring among us now. Cities in those days were called inhuman. These days they are called war zones. It all seems credible, at any given time, perhaps in part because the ideal of the organic society, philosophically respectable since 1800, has predisposed us to accept it. In course of time, it exhausted its field of research, since the researchers themselves were a corrupting Western contact. An anthropologist told me that he and his colleagues now do polling. The question at the center of it all was and is how societies cohere and what in them promotes human flourishing. The United States, by the theoretical lights of the old anthropology, was impossible. It was the great instance of a society that was not organic, not rooted in ancestral soil and ancestral blood, but instead a quasi-nation fabricated from materialism and from certain discredited Enlightenment ideas. When I was in school, it was a commonplace among foreign observers and certain American savants that we did not and could not have a national character or culture. We could not even know what it was we lacked, that being profundity, which, to the deracinated, is only a word. We were theoretically impossible, like so many of the planets that circle other suns. But there they are, and here we are, endlessly circling a few old texts, and an idea or two, stable through continuous change while other countries falter. Our culture has inordinate reach and very substantial prestige. Our national character is as distinctive as any. Nostalgia falsifies. It encourages the notion that we must once have had the authenticity and fellow feeling supposedly to be derived from a common stock. Colonial New England was as near as America has ever come to ethnic and religious homogeneity, and here is how the theologian Jonathan Edwards, in 1746, described religious culture among his contemporaries. "The daughter of Zion, the church in this land, now lies on the ground in such piteous circumstances as we now behold her, with her garments rent, her face disfigured, her nakedness exposed, her limbs broken, and weltering in the blood of her own wounds, and in no wise able to arise." Religious life went on, of course, in New England as elsewhere. Edwards says, "God's people in general have their minds unhinged and unsettled in things of religion, and many are brought into doubts whether there be anything at all in religion, and heresy and infidelity and atheism greatly prevail." These would be the nuns. Our laws and customs allow for our being a contentious people. Yet wherever disputes arise, panic ensues. We really should take whatever comfort we can and draw whatever conclusions we must from the fact that we are prone to alarm, a little inclined to frighten ourselves on slight pretexts. Marx laments that the solidarity of the English working class was drained away by the California gold rush. In the early 20th century, the German language competed seriously with English to become the national language until the World Wars suppressed it. We speak of our history in ways that imply continuities where there were in fact continuous intrusions of external events, wars, famines, and persecutions abroad, as well as the effects of internal developments, for example the cotton trade and the forced immigration of Africans as slaves, the recruitment of foreign labor to build the railroads or work in the steel mills and coal mines. All this is subsumed under American history, as it should be. But the word American encourages selective memory, and the Africans, Chinese, Polish, and Welsh are lost to the notion of a population always English-speaking, always Western European. The Midwest is seen as homogeneous: German Catholics, German Lutherans, German Mennonites. The lions have lain down with the lambs. The miracle of this country is that by world standards it is a union, stable and coherent, even as its heterogeneity increases in every generation. To call this a miracle is only to say it is a fact that at this point lacks explanation. The idea of the organic society, united by blood, faith, language, and culture, attractive as it may sound, actually tears societies apart, since some intolerable difference can always be found, some old wrong remembered. These have been the grounds for separatist movements in Britain and Europe, for conflicts in India and the Arab states. Those who invoke the idea of a real America would like to import a problem history has so far spared us. Take just the assertion that America is a Christian country. There is a history of appalling conflict among the churches and sects called Christian, which, by the grace of God, they left on the battlefields and scaffolds of Europe when they came here. The moment Christianity is established, we will begin to notice that it is extremely various, and we will begin to think about who the real Christians are, a group more than liable to exclude me, of course, since my co-religionist, the president, is excluded already. Those ideas that have so far held us together are very beautiful. That is their power. That they could have had the authority for us they have had is a thing worth noting, even while the crudest passages of our history make it clear that we can resist them fiercely and distort their meaning utterly, and that at best we are slow in understanding how very much they imply. Surely they offer more basis for a generalization about human nature than any number of cave paintings or kinship systems, precisely because they are not local and they are not relics or survivals. They enlist the loyalty and fire the aspirations of a vast and various and continuously changing population through generations and centuries. Insofar as we feel the difference between what our country is and what these ideals proclaim, human equality realized in sacred and inalienable rights, they are always in advance of us. It is in this sense that the genius of our past is the promise of our future. It is in this sense that we can always speak of hope. My respect for Barack Obama is vast and unshadowed. Given the information, advice, and reflection his decisions have proceeded from, I might have made other choices from time to time. But this by no means casts doubt on his wisdom or motives, any more than it endorses mine. A modern president is alone with endless decisions, many very grave. It is an accident of history that the weight of the world should fall on his or her shoulders, a consequence of our relative stability in a disorderly world, and of the basic effectiveness of our political system, which have been indispensable to our greatness, if one is inclined to use the word, to have been unfailingly dignified, gracious, competent, and humane under such pressures, is a very moving achievement, an endurance that is more than heroic. That this president had no help from his opposition, that they did what they could to shake and discredit him, to weaken him in this country and therefore in the world, and that he kept his poise through it all and met the demands of his office with deliberate, gentlemanly calm, is a gift to our history, an example every one of us can learn from. It is true that he righted the economy, reformed health care, and protected our domestic tranquility as effectively as the availability of homicidal weapons will permit, all great achievements. He has had little help from certain of his friends who think it is becoming in them to express disillusionment, to condemn drone warfare or the encroachments of national security, never proposing better options than these painful choices, which, by comparison with others on offer, clearly spare lives. The president has done nothing more important than to stand against, above, the vulgar, mean-spirited noise that disheartens the public and alienates good people from politics, which is the one true, essential, and indispensable life of democracy. I have had a singular relationship with President Obama. I cannot imagine a greater honor than his having called me his friend. But if I call our relationship more than meaningful acquaintance, I might suggest a degree of personal familiarity that I cannot claim. We have had conversations. His expressed interest in my work has had a marked effect on my career, very marked in Europe, because he is held in such high regard there. The association of his name with mine abroad has let me see him as he is seen, where the miasmas of polemic do not obscure him, as a gracious, good, and brilliant man. There he is a vindication of American democracy, while here every means has been tried to deny the public the consequences of having chosen him. Having spoken with the president, having had some direct experience of his humor, his intelligence and courtesy, and his goodness, I consider it probable that those who have opposed him so intractably did so because they knew how remarkable a leader he could be. They were threatened with the possibility of a great president, one who could lead the country in a direction they did not favor and give prestige to a vision they did not share. At the incalculable cost to the country of exciting racial animosities in response to his historic election, they have damaged him as they could. So this other greatness, his accepting the discipline that comes with a reverence for the people and the country, has been thrown into prominence. There is a beauty at the center of American culture, which, when it is understood, is expressed in a characteristic eloquence. Every new articulation renews the present life of the country and enriches historic memory to the benefit of future generations. Barack Obama speaks this language, a rare gift. He is ours in the deep sense that Lincoln is ours, a proof, a test, and an instruction. We see ourselves in him, and in him we embrace or reject what we are. The Beautiful Changes, the Veritas Forum at Northwestern University, April 15, 2015. One wading a fall meadow finds on all sides the Queen Anne's lace lying like lilies on water. Richard Wilbur, The Beautiful Changes. I have come to the conclusion that reality in its nature precludes nothing, that its operations might be taken to reflect God's freedom on the one hand and his courtesy on the other, freedom to act outside the notion of possibility we abstract from the lawfulness of the world he gives us to inhabit, and courtesy that makes the world in fact lawful, allowing us to be capable, within the limits of given reality, to build and plan, to see our intentions through to their effects, to pass through the strange, rich stages of mortal life. God's freedom is expressed in what is usually called miracle, but I think the world of human experience itself should be thought of as miraculous as well, root and branch, more miraculous in nothing than in the lawfulness that differentiates it so sharply from the seeming antinomianism of deeper reality. The dazzlements of the subatomic notwithstanding, nor the torrential expansion of space-time, the world of our experience feels knowable, stable, and predictable, and it usually is. In saying this, I wish to establish, first of all, that divine freedom pre-exists and infinitely exceeds the reality we know, and that our reality is an act of divine restraint, a covenant made with earthly life that puts self-imposed limits on a power that would otherwise overwhelm us, would effectively annihilate us. This little garden, Earth, implies an act of creation which was radically, for us, incomprehensibly free. It implies an act and an intention that are expressed in the world of our experience designedly or arbitrarily. It would be given certain features and qualities to the exclusion of an infinity of others that, if they had been chosen, would have had a part in it. Its given qualities are therefore no basis for reconstructing the creative act itself, however expressive they might be of the intent behind it. In other words, what seems to us possible and reasonable on the basis of our experience cannot be understood as conditioning or limiting reality beyond the structures of our experience. This fact is as true and important for a physicist as it ought to be for a theologian. The physicist would, of course, put aside any thought of intent, any teleology, but the theist need not, must not. And as much as I respect science and its methods, here the theologian can claim a great advantage, conceptually speaking. She need not struggle to breathe life into a purely materialist cosmos. She need not attempt a grand unifying theory out of the heterogeneous parts of known reality. She need not leave unaddressed the fact of the extraordinary role of human consciousness in the cosmos, of which physics is one great instance. On the other hand, she is free to absorb into her account of reality elements that are anomalous, not to be arrived at by positivist reasoning. So imperious is the materialist approach to reality that it considers whatever it cannot capture by its methods as effectively non-existent, for example, the human self, the human mind. It marginalizes to the point of disappearance things we generally consider abstractions, for example, justice, wisdom, and beauty. The theologian may and must grant these even an especial reality. Some part of a definition of beauty ought to be that it is an aspect of experience that can and possibly should compel attention and also reward it. To say this is to grant it an objective existence of some kind, a place in the economy of needs and rewards that bonds humankind to the world, that engrosses the mind in experience. Yet the idea of beauty varies from one perceiver to the next, one decade to the next, and from culture to culture. At the same time, it is so important in the shaping of human life that the sense of it may do more than any other influence to make a culture distinctive. The Parthenon, St. Basil's Cathedral, the Taj Mahal, variously and authoritatively epitomize the aesthetics of a singular place and period. Sometimes, with a little instruction, we can recognize varieties of beauty we could never otherwise approximate or even imagine. If existence were designed to engraft us into the world, to charm and engage us, what could be better suited to accomplishing this than beauty, with its inexhaustible openness to variation, with its frangible and circumstantial rules and limits, which enable invention and tantalize perception? The theologian can say that beauty eludes definition because it expresses the grace of God, like other elusive things, say, time and light. It takes its nature from its purpose, its intended effect. Photons famously elude definition. I am not transgressing against reason when I say that essential aspects of reality confound our categories, or that they are mutable in relation to their perceivers. I am simply allowing my account of reality some of the breadth appropriate to its subject. Much thinking about human things has been captive for a very long time to the methods and biases of anthropology. And anthropology has been governed by the assumption of an original simplicity in all things human, complicated over time, at least among the majority of the species, until we arrive at modernity. A misunderstanding of non-Western languages was based on and has encouraged the idea of an original simplicity. It appeared to justify the notion that their speakers were themselves primitive. But no matter how serious the problems with this schema, no matter how much complexity is always discovered in supposed simplicity, this model has never really been replaced. Both language and beauty have mutability and accommodation as qualities that are essential to them. Both shape and are shaped continuously as they are realized in our reflections, choices, and creations. Like the genome, both are uncannily well-suited to exist, to flourish, in time. Futurity is implied in them in the fact of their constrained mutability. If the starting point for language was not an original simplicity, a business of threats and warnings, perhaps, how else is language to be accounted for? What magic or miracle could have intervened to yield the very great complexity that characterizes human utterance as we know it? This is a real question. The theologian might say that language is essential to human nature, and that it bears relation to the expressed intent manifest in all creation. In the beginning was the Word. This is a statement of faith, granted. Still, it is fully consistent with the great potency of language. If our interest is in the given world, the world of experience, then unserviceable theories of origins ought to be put aside in favor of attention to the things themselves, leaving accounts of beginnings to the sacred unknowable, or to the empirically unknown and perhaps unknowable. Surely no theory should persist simply for want of a better one, when the theory clearly distorts its purported subject. Beauty is equally inaccessible to positivist accounts. It has no consistent usefulness, is the product of no fixed colors or proportions, is not reliably associated with well-being. It is indeed in the eye of the beholder, an eye that can be helped by instruction and experience, is in any case much influenced by them, and may, by its decisions, refine and extend the consensus surrounding the beautiful, at least within the limits of a culture and period. I may seem to be comparing unlike things. While forms and manifestations of language are very real and constantly present to us, beauty is ordinarily treated as an abstraction, this despite its unquestionable power in our experience. I do not say a conception of beauty, because there is an urge or a tropism that lies behind all conceptions of beauty, wildly as they differ, and it is this that interests me. I have come to doubt the usefulness of abstraction as a category, not only because of its suggestions of static unworldliness, but also because it distracts attention from the active and vital properties of these entities that so variously weave our lives into them as they preserve and transform history, culture, speculation, and belief, as well as the interior narratives of all our individual lives. Justice, another great abstraction, is defined differently in every age and culture, and is felt as a reality billions of times a day as it is approximated or satisfied or offended, or as it is modified in light of circumstance. It has a very great practical power in any moment, though it too is subject to change, whether through increases in refinement or lapses into malice or revenge. A creation that was arbitrary in the way I suggest might include the fiat, "Let there be justice," or "Let there be beauty," each having the properties I describe intrinsically, not as proceeding from circumstance, or as having somehow evolved from material conditions with which they have no kinship. Science tells us that any number of universes are possible, in theory, and that life is so adaptable it could occur in forms unimagined by us. So science and theology can agree on one great point. Our reality has properties that could have been radically unlike those we know and experience. If being is a cascade of accident, each moment determining the particulars of the next and therefore excluding other possibilities, we are still left with the fact of the very remarkable substances and energies that are and have been so beautifully configured at every scale. Be that as it may. Theology, on the other hand, asserts intention rather than accident, and in doing so, it captures an essential characteristic of reality, that is, its coherency and mutability, its temporal being as both and simultaneously self-identical and subject to and capable of varieties of change too numerous to reckon. The biblical creation narrative allows us to say that the world was made to have the qualities of life, that is, to exist in time, to change and be changed freely, within real but rarely absolute limits. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Nations and languages arose out of the growth and dispersing of population. Profound differences did not impinge upon essential identity, as science can tell us, though historically and at present the differences seem to matter most to us. There is a mighty paradox in identity. The infant and the old man are one self. The life-changing event can only modify a particular life, which came before it and will continue after it. Yet the change is real, even profound, and beauty, intrinsic and perceived, attends on every change, transforming itself, refining itself to engage the altered mind again. This renewed encounter with beauty is often experienced as a manifestation of grace. Beauty awaits our notice, while as experience it is eloquently modified by our histories and temperaments, speaking to us one by one, soul by soul. Beauty is grandly present in the architecture of the cosmos, minutely present in the structure of the atom, and yet we humans can seem capable of utter indifference to it. But I have begun to feel that our ability to do wrong is the basis of our moral nature, that our bias toward error gives meaning and urgency to our seeking after truth, that our blindnesses make the beautiful, pervasive as it is, always an object of discovery, a thing to be yearned for. Just as the norms of our experience of existence are radically untypical of the universe of being we can reasonably infer, with its entanglements and indeterminacies, its dark matter and anti-gravity, so we are singular among creatures precisely in our capacity to refine and elaborate our understanding in the awareness of its shortfall. It is this in us that has made tiny blue earth a singular seraphic presence in the great cosmos, watching and pondering, rapt with wonder. We can feel deficiency in what we know or do, we can hear inadequacy in our most painfully considered phrases, and gracious and chimerical beauty will bless us with the certainty that there is more to be hoped for, more to be tried. The theologian can say all this implies divine intention and also continuous loving engagement. Because God has created the universe, humankind is at the center of it all. Our public conversation, how America talks about itself. The Paige Barber Lectures at the University of Virginia, February 22nd to 26th, 2016. Recently, I read a brief overview of myself and my work, an article on the internet. It said that if someone were bioengineered to personify unhipness, the result would be Marilyn Robinson. The writer listed the qualities that have earned me this distinction. I am in my 70s, I was born in Idaho, I live in Iowa, I teach in a public university, and I am a self-professed Calvinist. Ah, well, I will only grow older, I am happy in Iowa, my religion is my religion. That I was born in Idaho will be true forever, so I can put aside any slightest unacknowledged thought of satisfying the standards of hipness. The review was cautiously positive despite all this, warning and alluring and also flattering its readers with the assurance that in me they will find thinking that is very unlike their own. Fair enough. The article did make me think, though, how inclined Americans are to find their way to some sheltering consensus that will tell them what to wear, what to eat, what to read, how to vote, what to think. There is nothing new in this observation of mine, though perhaps I am unusual in considering these aggregations in terms of the mass of things they leave unconsidered, neglected, and unknown. Looking back, I realize that I have spent a great part of my adult life working to rescue wounded or discounted reputations. I've always known that there are risks. To say that Jonathan Edwards is not hip is to test the limits of understatement. As much might be said of Shakespeare's Henry VI plays, John Calvin, Puritanism. At this point in my life, there can be no doubt about the tropisms of my mind and soul, even though for a long time I thought I was just tidying up a few misunderstandings for my own sake before I went on to other work. I somehow thought I was devoting the time to people and things that lacked poetry, were utterly unpoetical, believing what was always told me, implicitly and explicitly. These stereotypes are hard to eradicate, however unwelcome they might be. Distinguished names associated with Puritanism in England include Edmund Spenser, Marian Philip Sidney, Arthur Golding, Thomas Middleton, Fulke Greville, Andrew Marvell, John Milton, John Bunyan. In Britain, social and legal disabilities as well as outright persecution discouraged nonconformist loyalties, especially before and after the Parliamentary Revolution and the Commonwealth. So the style of thought, the worldview associated with Puritanism, naturalized itself to the environment of the dominant culture. But about these figures I have named, there is no ambiguity. It is true that their writing does not satisfy the polemical sense of the word Puritan, which is so overwhelmingly its modern sense that the most careful efforts at historical precision in the use of the word are always compromised by its associations with priggishness, acquisitiveness, hypocrisy, narrow-mindedness, and fanaticism. Still, for years I accepted, or did not know how to reject, the bleak stereotype, when it is precisely the poetry of Puritanism, and more generally the use and celebration of the English language always associated with it, that has enlisted my devoted attention. I am fascinated by history, and I don't know what it is. I believe that whatever it is profoundly important, and I don't know why. I am especially fascinated by erasures and omissions, which seem to me to be strongly present in their apparent absence, like black holes pulling the fabric of collective narrative out of shape. Europeans often say our culture is Puritan, Lollard, according to Freud, and we don't know enough history to understand what they might mean by this. We have made a project of freeing ourselves of even minimal standards of taste or discretion, and still the word clings. Ethical rigor, aversion to display, the ideal of vocation, are all diminished things among us, and still we are Puritan. Most recently I heard us denounced in these terms at a dinner table in London. How horrifying are rules against sexual harassment! It is the most natural thing in the world for students to fall in love with their professors, subordinates with their superiors, and so on. My suggestion that this might all seem very different from the perspective of the student or the subordinate, and my thoughts about fairness, merit, and so on, were not of interest. They were merely one more puritanical pretext for denying the pleasures of life. I think in many cases puritanical may simply mean reformist, tending to assume that even very settled cultural patterns and practices can be called into question, that they are not presumptively endorsed by culture, that what is traditional cannot claim, therefore, to be rooted in human nature. We tend to forget that our revolution was won in a series. Geneva expelled its Savoyard rulers and was governed by elected councils. The Dutch expelled the Habsburg Emperor and in the process trained sympathetic British volunteers who took the experience home with them. Then, with the Puritan Revolution, England tried and executed its king and attempted a decade of parliamentary government. More than a century later, the American colonies rejected monarchy as a system on the basis of the abuses of the king then in power. This is not logical, strictly speaking, but it affiliated the Americans with the great precedent of the English Revolution, the Revolution of Milton and Marvel. The most revolutionary idea contained in all this is that society as a whole can be and should be reformed. This Puritan energy does indeed continue to animate American life. Sometimes, on the strength of a reformist movement, history is recovered. There are innumerable instances of this in the last half century, in this country often as a consequence of the civil rights movement. In Europe, perhaps as a secondary consequence of this movement, Britain, the Netherlands, and other countries have begun to acknowledge the enormous extent of their roles in the Atlantic slave trade. It says a great deal about human consciousness, collective and individual, that a phenomenon of such scale, duration, and consequence could be obscured so thoroughly. One of the many advantages of my long life is that I remember how things were before that old oblivion began to break up a little. The past really is a foreign country, even the near past, the one you have lived through. You have to have been there to have anything like a true sense of it. This does not make the past understandable, any more than living now makes the present understandable, but it does allow you to call to mind the cohesion of its elements from which the whole strange mindset derived its authority, as dreams and eras and cultures do, always including our own. We continue to learn how important slavery and racism have been to the construction of Western civilization, literally as well as figuratively. Without question, we have vastly more to learn. Through all this, it is important to remember that history that is grossly incomplete can feel coherent, sufficient, and true. The reality of history, whatever it is perhaps best demonstrated by the power it has when the tale it tells is false. Coherence means something like stickiness, adhesion. An assumption, if it is firmly held, and especially if it is unconscious, will attract information that preserves or renews its stability, testing its credibility as information by its stickiness, rejecting anything that will not be assimilated to it. Unless, and then only in certain cases, some external shock or some shift of consensus causes it to decohere, to lose the logic of its structure. If you are deep in a dream and someone knocks at the door, that giant elusive spider you are now trying to kill with a hammer will vanish at the next knock, and the coherency that made the creature real and threatening will disintegrate. And in half a minute, that logic will be wholly irrecoverable. Any model of reality tends to perpetuate itself, if it can, on a principle of coherence peculiar to itself. And this is true of the narratives of history. It is somehow also true of history itself. True, that is, of whatever has actually happened, the unacknowledged history that haunts us and perhaps also invests our societies with their distinctiveness, like that Puritanism of ours. I have read that the interaction of dark matter with itself is based not on gravity, but on friction. I have no idea what this might mean, except that dark matter being by far the preponderant form of matter in the universe, good old gravity could be only one relatively minor structuring principle of it all. In their absence from our awareness, essential things are not missed, though they still are present and essential. I have been reading things Shakespeare and his audience might have read in order to understand both of them better. Literacy was high then, driven by tracts and pamphlets that were addressed precisely to those who, in other generations, would have had very limited access to printed or written material and little or no ability to read it. There were widely circulated newspapers that covered the wars on the continent. There were chronicle histories, which implicitly addressed the great questions of royal succession and legitimacy. Most popular of all these during Shakespeare's lifetime was a great tome, larger in each of its editions, The Acts and Monuments of the Martyrs by John Fox. The book is famous for its illustrations depicting martyrdoms and for the care and the remarkable sophistication of its printing. But I had never seen it. I went to the Folger Library in Washington, D.C., and asked to look at it, assuming that an eminent Shakespeare library would have copies of a book he and his audience would have been very likely to have had some acquaintance with. In fact, they had, they told me, only one copy that was in good enough condition to be looked at, and that one only because a scholar using the library had arranged to have it bound at his own expense. Fox's Book of Martyrs was a central text of English and American Puritanism. It is a polemic, certainly, a pre-revolutionary work, but it is also an extraordinary work of historical documentation in English, Latin, and, where needed, Greek. The Chronicle histories bear no comparison to it. Its importance as an extraordinary specimen of Renaissance publishing should be sufficient by itself to protect it from being left to molder away from neglect in an archive devoted to Renaissance culture. I feel I am probably fair in taking the marginalizing of Fox's book to be an effect of its association with Puritanism, a sort of editing of history, which I must assume is important in very many contexts, but which I notice in this one instance because of my particular interests. That said, Shakespeare is hardly an interest I can claim to have to myself. There is a Toryism in Elizabethan studies that yields a model of culture that must exclude, for example, this important book, because its very importance throws many things into question about Shakespeare and the public he addressed. A comparable and related phenomenon is the history of the Bible of Shakespeare, Milton, and Marvel, that is, the Geneva Bible, which was out of print from 1644 to 2007. There is a great deal of reverence accorded the King James or Authorized Version on the theory that it was the watershed for all that wonderful language, and this despite the fact that it was published in 1611, when Shakespeare's career was at an end. The Geneva Bible was the Bible of the Puritans. It is the King James Version, just not yet shorn of the marginal commentary that instructed its readers in the reformed understanding of the text, and not yet purged of language that might seem politically dangerous. What did Scripture look like to the generations who saw it in a form not authorized, that telling word? How many thousands of scholars have not wondered how Shakespeare's work could have been influenced by a book published in 1611? Very many American scholars are royalists of the imagination, wistful onlookers, too in love with their Elizabethan world picture even to acknowledge how badly it accords with the actual brilliance and spirit and repressiveness and violence of the age. I have arrived at the conclusion that American history is substantially false, though not exceptionally so, and that many of these falsifications go back to a source that is older than the country, earlier than the colonies. I dwell on American history because it is mine, and because it is the screen on which the national psyche is projected. I would like to think America might go on for a very long time, always recognizable in its best qualities, however it may transform itself otherwise. I assume most Americans would agree that the essence of the project did find classic expression in 1776 and 1789. It seems to me that for the survival of our experiment to be even imaginable, the country must know itself much better. 1,000 problems arise immediately, of course. I was talking to people in a library in Iowa City about the abolitionist movement and the Civil War. A woman came up to me afterward in a state of scarcely controlled irritation and asked me why any of this should interest her when no one in her family was even here at the time of the Civil War. She had a point. The true history of the United States is rewritten day by day. Yet the fact is that we were a string of British colonies for almost as long as we have been an independent country. And during that long time, the trade and industrial policies of British and other European governments established slave labor in the Americas. So far as we can know, nothing of greater consequence ever happened on this continent, except for colonization itself. The Civil War is only the most spectacular instance of its impact on our civilization, which is ongoing, as we all know. It is true and always to be remembered that the great influx of Africans, was a gift to the culture that has given it a brilliance and rich distinctiveness the whole world enjoys. That they came as captives and lived as slaves is an inexpressible grief and transgression. In other words, it is not ethnocentricity that makes early America of such interest to me. On the contrary, ethnocentricity is what makes our history avert its gaze from our Anglo-European origins. We prefer to speak as if our society had neither source, context, nor analog, insofar as its doings are or have been in any way regrettable. We were somehow spontaneously generated, like toads from the mud of the Nile, and were instantly up to our special version of no good. To want to keep discredit to itself, to insist on the utter uniqueness of its sins and errors, might seem generous or rigorous in a country, but it is neither of these because it has nothing to do with the truth. In Adam's fall, we sinned all, the English in Ireland, Australia, the Caribbean, and here, the Belgians in Congo, the Spanish in Argentina, the Russians in Ukraine. The list is infinitely far from complete, as we all know. Its beginnings are undiscoverable. Phenomena of the kind it names are infinitely far from being ended. If we could let ourselves have anything like a real sense of history, we would not be so continuously surprised and bewildered by its latest permutations. It seems conventional among historians to say that the American Revolution wasn't about much, that the liberalizations brought on by the evolution of the British parliamentary system would have yielded the same freedoms without all the uproar. This view of things is deeply uninformed, because we avert our gaze, and it has the effect of making the generations who began and sustained the revolution of little historic interest. In the South were the plantation owners, with all the problems this involves. In the North were the Northerners, generally described as Puritans or Calvinists, with all the problems this involves. We have left ourselves nowhere to place our sympathies. Our solution is to project on England and Britain an imagined aloofness from our sins and errors, despite the fact that problems that perplex and disgrace us descend from our long colonial period and its aftermath, during which time Britain emerged as a great industrial power on the back of all that uncompensated toil in American cotton fields. What does it matter? Everything always matters. Years ago, during the thaw in relations between the United States and Russia, I went to an exhibition of the Romanov jewels. Off to the side, out of the way, there was a display of photos and newspaper articles about the Russian intervention in the Civil War on the side of the Union. Tsar Nicholas II sent his fleets to the harbors of New York and San Francisco, where they remained through much of the war. He did this to prevent intervention on the side of the South by England and France, which, along with Russia, were the great powers of the time. The British had begun a gradual emancipation in the West Indies in 1837, but they came very near attempting to enforce a peace, that is, a permanent division of this country that would have left American slavery intact and ensured the flow of American cotton to those nightmarish factories in Manchester and Lyon. There was much gratitude and celebration here over the arrival of these formidable Russians, to whom we might in fact be said to owe our national existence. How did we manage to forget this? The 1860s are a much studied period in our history, needless to say, and by world standards not a very distant one. Might this intervention not have been a good thing to remember during all those years when Russia was made to seem so intractably alien to us? But the tale does not reflect well on England or France. It does not cohere with our image of Northern Europe as our always better self. I propose this as an instance of that tendency of fact, of truth to be excluded when it is not assimilable to some settled and preferred vision of things, a vision it would complicate. Truth would be a leaven in the lump, so to speak, giving the whole narrative an element of truth in the form of complexity. Complexity is powerfully stripped away by half-informed or uninformed aversion. Why should people so often feel what amounts to contempt for figures, even entire populations, about whom they know nothing and will learn nothing on the grounds of this same aversion? The word Orwellian has been worked nearly to death because it is so very useful. Consensus really ought not to trump reason or preclude it, though it does, routinely. And reason always tells us that human beings and their societies and histories are mingled, That is, never only to be condemned, sometimes ingratiating or admirable. Decent mutual respect depends on an awareness of this fact, that is, on good history. A conscious strategy currently favored for excluding complications